Welcome to Bibliosinensis Season 2!
Yay! Welcome back, everyone.
How are you guys doing?
Hello, Hauntiers!
Ah, yes. Welcome back, dear Hauntiers. So, now that we are here, I can't believe we've made it this far. September.
Yeah, we hope you're cozying up, enjoying the slightly cooler weather, I hope, in your area. We've dropped about 10 degrees here in LA.
Oh my goodness, it's a real rager with all this fire.
Yes, it's been interesting.
Yes. Nevertheless, we are still reading, and we would like to announce that season two is
about writers.
Yeah!
Yeah.
Loving this. Knowing that everybody is actually a reader and also a writer, thanks to all of you guys participating in Bibliosinensis on Instagram.
Yeah, and thanks a bazillion for your comments and replies and suggestions.
We're able to actually talk about this. Being a writer, the loneliness of being a writer, the success of being a writer, the beauty.
Our episode 6, our last episode, which was Summer Reads, a lot of response on that.
Yeah.
A lot of response on, I want to hear about your writing life.
Yeah.
I'm like, well.
So, it gave me a huge comfort that you guys voted that the Hemingways were better writers than the Fitzgeralds. It made me so happy and at home because I brought in two writers within the Hemingway picture, and then, obviously, Scott and Zelda, which basically were interchangeably Scott Fitzgerald anyways.
That's the sad part, isn't it?
I know. But it gave me huge comfort. I love it. And I love you guys for it.
Yeah, all of you that have been participating, it has been lots of fun.
So, what are we having today, actually, before we continue?
So, for all of you who are looking for all the little details about T-Spectral when you join this podcast, this is an exclusive.
All right.
We are drinking Cozy Cottage today.
Cozy Cottage. What is this?
Cozy Cottage is the collaboration for the exclusive blend that is just It's a Charming Life.
Ah, fantastic.
Yeah, so last year we did a Sweater Weather and Chin Chin Tin with them, and they did the artwork for that.
What was his name again?
It's Jonas.
Yes.
Woodland Library.
There we go.
Shout out to him. And he created this beautiful artwork to house our tins, and it was the first time we actually sold about 4 ounces.
Right.
At a time. We usually have like 1.5, like basically between 1 to 2 ounce bags.
Yes.
So it was kind of a big deal. Those were the seasonal blends people were buying like 2s or 3s of.
Yeah.
And so I was like, why don't we just make a big tin? And then that way you don't have to buy 2s or 3s. So
it's hard enough to get through any of the bags anyways.
Yeah.
But I am impressed by that. I mean, I'm very happy to actually know that you guys are avid drinkers.
Yeah, so a little, I guess, tea tidbit for everybody is we are releasing tins with them for this blend.
Oh.
And it's actually going to be 3 ounces.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. It is the same size as the tins from last year. It's just the type of material in this tea is a lot fluffier, if that makes sense. It's airier, looser.
Okay.
Yeah, so take a sip and tell me what you taste. All right. Cheers.
Cheers. Sarsaparilla.
Do you taste the sarsaparilla? Because there is actual sarsaparilla in it.
Not at first, but I'm tasting.
Like a root beer note?
Yeah, like it's like a soda without the fizz or the syrup.
Okay.
You know, it's very, how shall I say, Americana.
Yeah. And that's pretty much what I wanted from it. I wanted it to taste very vintage because they're all about the vintage lifestyle.
Okay.
And they live in a cottage. So yes. Cottagecore is super trendy right now. But they did it before it was trendy, I guess.
Yeah.
I think they've lived at this Cobweb Cottage for, what, 3 years now?
So that basically makes everybody that's using the hashtag just posers now.
Yeah.
God.
But they actually live very, they call it art of slow living. And slow living is learning to just savor old-fashioned practices. So they do a lot of baking, strolls in the woods. They actually ironically live next to a cemetery.
Ah, that would do it.
Near Sleepy Hollow. So they do a lot of like gothic walks in the graveyard.
Must be very quiet.
Yeah. Great neighbors, right?
Exactly.
So I wanted to encapsulate that. And like you said, Americana is like a very perfect term for it. I thought a lot about like just classic jam making.
Yeah.
I'm a mason jar addict. If anyone has noticed on the Instagram feeds of Tea Spectral, I am a huge advocate of mason jar everything. And so I always, like, my attention just went to, like, jam. And then one of the cute things is, I didn't know this when I was creating the tea for them. And we went through a lot of different prototypes. I think we went through 8 total.
Oh,
it was
my God.
Pretty difficult. But they knew specifically what they wanted, so we just kept going. And then originally we were going to do apple, because I thought apple pie, very classic.
Yeah.
And it just was not registering. So okay. Last minute, as like a Hail Mary, I kind of pulled a bunch of berry notes in. So this has raspberry and blackberry, and they absolutely love it. And then they were like, oh my God, how did you know that we have wild raspberry brambles in the back of the cottage? And I'm like, I had no idea whatsoever. So it just tied in really great.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So when I was designing this tea, I just felt if you were a Southern belle in the 1800s, what kind of teas or tea sandwiches would you have on a summer porch or something like that?
Yeah, that's interesting that you brought it up, because historically, they had fried chicken back in those days.
Yeah.
So a lot of like what we consider as just like sometimes fast food.
Or like dainty. Like, we would think tea time's dainty, but, like,
yeah.
Back then it was pretty hearty.
Yeah, it was. Very hearty. So this is nice.
Yeah, you know? So, I mean, if you're into, like, classic apple pies or berry cobblers, or you like, you know, old-fashioned sarsaparilla, like, pop.
Yeah.
This is all that wrapped into a tea.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Perfect. So, being that, we are shifting our attention from reading to writing. Am I correct?
Yeah, we are. So there's a lot of things in fall that make you think of writing. I mean, cozying up, you want to do a lot of indoor activities. So
yeah.
Not like we haven't had enough with COVID. But I guess the appropriate season for it is now.
Right.
And then National Novel Writing Month is in November.
Yes. If anyone knows about NaNoWriMo, it's basically the marathon of writing.
Right. It's kind of like that huge run you do every year. And we'll get into that through the season. But we just figured now is the time to talk about this stuff.
Yes.
Because I'm sure there's a lot of people that are ready to nest. I know that I nest at this time and I get ready to do my writing.
Yes.
So.
Especially with the cold weather.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we've got you. Caffeine and
conversation. You are not alone.
So hopefully this season we can give them some comfort.
So first time writers, welcome. Veteran writers,
we got you.
Yeah, we got
we
you.
Understand.
Yeah, we'll get through this.
Yeah, so let's dive in.
Yes, what do we have?
So today's episode is actually about the way that writers that read think.
Okay.
And how they think differently from just readers.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, like I don't know if you noticed once you started writing. Did you feel like you noticed different things?
Yeah, yeah. I know that it wasn't just the details I was actually starting to enjoy more, but it's the technicality of how they actually got to portray certain insights. You know, like when people actually explain like how it feels like to bite into a muffin. Like, you don't think twice about that. But when you start becoming a writer, you start realizing, like, oh my goodness, they found a way to make it sound delicious. Or they made me hungry. Like, that's amazing, you know? Especially for people that are just starting out. Because a lot of these analogies and a lot of these similes are just, we don't get enough of them. Yeah. At least, I don't think you do until you start writing. So, at least that's my, you know, two cents. I mean, like, what about you?
I notice things that are very sensory in writing that I hadn't noticed before. And it's something I love. Like, every time I get, I guess I get blown back by the way they describe things.
Right.
It's quite the experience. It makes me want to capture emotions that way. And there's like a few I think of, like, I don't know who's the author for The Indian in the Cupboard.
Oh, yes, I remember that book.
But my goodness, the way he wrote how it feels to start to cry when you're upset.
Yeah.
And the way he used the analogy of drinking something so hot that it burns the back of your throat and you can't control like the searing pain going down.
Yeah.
It stuck with me. I mean, I read that when I was a kid and it still stuck with me. Right. You know, it's phenomenal. And another book that's just very inspirational for me and I hope one day to ever like to write at that level is The Tale of Despero.
Oh.
Yes. I mean, I love that book to the point where my dog is named Despero. I just love, I guess, that way of explaining hard times and when things don't go your way, or like even the way she kind of just explains depression.
Right.
Without saying depression feels like this. It's like, well, you know, sometimes you just need to be brave. Exactly. And she's just wonderful at weaving stories. So I notice those things now that I'm a writer.
Right. I remember you telling me, like, one of your favorite scenes from The Scarlet Letter was walking through that hall of armor.
Yes, I love that scene. So yeah. I love that scene. I believe Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote The Scarlet Letter, right? But where, it was Hester, right?
I believe so.
Hester's the main character. She's walking around in, like, this stately home, I believe, and all of these suits of armor just reflect, because they're made out of metal, and they're all wearing the A, because they're reflecting the A off of her chest, and just feeling that, like, pulsation of guilt.
Right.
And contemplation.
Yeah, that's exactly what you actually think about after you start writing, to be honest.
Yeah.
But if you caught that while you were reading, then kudos to you.
Maybe you have a writer's brain.
Probably.
Yeah.
So, carry on. What's the article we found here?
Yeah, so this is actually a really surprising article. I just went to Google, like I do, and tried to find things. And normally we do two articles, but we're going to try to pare them down to one now for discussion. And this one did not disappoint.
All right.
It's actually from CNBC, and it is in the books and culture section, of course.
Huh.
It's written by Todd Brisson, and it's called Neuroscience Explains the Astonishing Benefits of Reading Books Like a Writer, Even If You Don't Plan on Becoming One.
All right.
So this is about basically how the brain takes in information as a writer versus just reading it, which we were talking about just now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I believe there's 4 points in this, but we'll just go down the list and I'd love to hear your opinion.
All right, bring it.
So the first thing they bring up in the points is the different techniques of reading and how you become more detailed and meticulous. It just changes you as a reader. Like, right. Your habits change. The example they use, which I don't know if I agree with this, but, you know, everybody's different, is Bill Gates and how Bill Gates never stops reading a book midway. Like, he will never give up a book.
Wow.
He even goes as far as saying he will take more time sometimes reading a book he hates than a book he loves because he will spend more time writing margin notes.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I slow down when I read things that I don't like, but not only just for the fact that it doesn't interest me, but just the fact that it doesn't, I can't relate. Double insult there, but that makes sense. I mean, annotating on a book is actually proper etiquette as a reader. Mm-hmm. You should be asking questions. You should actually put down your frustrations. I mean, like, it's okay to kind of say, like, I hate this character right now. Why is there a chapter based on this character? Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's okay. And I feel that when you do these, annotations, it helps you build yourself as a character. You know, having a conversation with the author or authoress. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times, you don't know how the author is actually thinking or feeling when they're writing a certain scene or chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And you gotta actually try to be sympathetic to the devil here. So, what about you, though?
I could say a lot of things about this. I mean, I was talking about the different things that I look for as a writer when I read. And those were some of the golden moments. But another thing I noticed that I pay a lot of attention to is the way that an author writes dialogue. Because I know that's a weakness of mine.
Right.
So I'm always curious to see what makes natural dialogue.
Exactly. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So I love the way things flow, like who writes excellent dialogue. Brian Jacobs writes absolutely amazing dialogue.
I enjoy Terry Pratchett.
Terry Pratchett is really good dialogue. It's a little scatterbrained, but I think that's part of the charm in it.
It is.
Who else writes really good dialogue that I'm, like, a little impressed by?
Would you say Selznick?
No. Selznick is more of a narrative. I would definitely say Helen Fielding.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
She is so good.
She writes incredible dialogue. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So, what else do we have?
Well, let's move on. The inside of the mind of a writer. It says that reading like a writer can actually help strengthen your skills in communicating and storytelling.
Okay.
It allows you to become more of a persuasive person. And it allows you to be more convincing because you can pitch things. So that can be in your career.
Right.
You can sell yourself, like, I guess, romantically.
Right.
Because it says in the end, your goal is to engage your readers. So when you think like a writer, you're able to understand that connection.
Right.
So, your opinion.
I will say if you are a good writer. I have read a lot of horrendous, you know, books out there. Usually, like, I guess they might be just from, like, fanatical fanfiction writers that wanted to be real writers and just could not handle the critique of and the high standards of fanfiction.net.
God forbid.
God forbid. And it's amazing over, like, what they would self-publish and they just forgot the reader along the way. So I must say, think like a good writer. Because there are horrendous writers out there. It's okay to be a bad writer. It's okay. I mean,
I think it's better to start as a bad writer.
It really is. Because
the more knocked down, I mean, since we're talking about experiences.
Yes.
We were just talking about this, how our first play was the most embarrassing thing.
Oh my god, that was like the most Mary Sue thing we ever done.
It was horrible.
Okay, it's like everybody else in college went to Miami, had like parties and raves, and we thought, we're not gonna be those people. We are intellectuals. We will rent a theater, and we will do a play professionally.
Well, I mean, it started kind of weird. Like, we wanted to do fundraising.
Yeah.
For, what, Anime Expo, or like some kind of... Well, we wanted to do some vacationing, basically. And we're like, oh, let's do a murder mystery dinner, and all of our family will pay to go here.
Exactly.
We were idiots. We were total idiots.
We were in our 20s.
But, you know,
it's fun. It's great to be in your 20s.
Here's a fun fact for all of you out there, because this is how my brain works, and this is why we have two businesses. I realized it was cheaper to rent a theater than a ballroom at a hotel. One thing led to another, and
yeah.
God bless his heart, Jean Bua took us in, and we were apparently there kind of crazy.
Yeah, it was like the first time I ever experienced a spit shake.
I spit shaked with Tony Balboa.
Yeah.
For the theater for, what, 2 weeks?
2 weeks.
But we had like 3 weeks of rehearsal space.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was...
That was amazing.
How old was I? 19?
19. You directed your first professional play at the age of 19.
And I wrote it, and let me tell you, it definitely sounded like it came from a 19-year-old. If not someone from junior high, because there was just... There was a lot of things we did really dumb. But I just remember not even, like, using autocorrect for the words. There was a psychologist in our play, and it kept saying physiologist. Even my actors pointed it out, and...
We refused.
And we refused, because it was for the art, and it was so raw.
I was like, don't correct it.
Oh! It was horrible.
It is my art!
Yeah, let us know if you want us to laughably, like... put that online.
Oh, I am going to put this online. It's on YouTube.
Oh, no, I'm talking about the actual play. Like,
The first act is on YouTube.
Oh, well, then we'll just have to share the first act.
If you could, yeah. It's in, like, the dark recesses of early YouTube, so
I'll find it. When did we write it? 2004 or something?
Yeah, we produced it 2005.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then... I think we put it on YouTube 2009 or something.
Who knows? It was like a long time ago. Let's just say that. We are ancient.
But because of that...
We call ourselves the ancient.
Oh, no.
No, we don't. No.
But because of that, we just became better writers. We had to go through it. We had to go through the humiliation. So. Yeah,
the bad reviews... The sad, like, I guess, patronization of the audience. And the embarrassment that I invited my family. And I'm so sorry about that, guys. I still apologize to my actors, even on Facebook.
Oh. Yeah. I didn't know that.
It's so weird. I'm like, always so cringy about it. I'm just like, yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry, guys. Like, I know you're all Asian, and I'm Asian, and we're just... I'm bringing a lot of Asians into this theater, but yeah, I'm embarrassed. I'm sorry. They're a little cringy sometimes, but they're lovable. I love them.
Okay.
Carry on.
Well, okay. So do you find yourself more persuasive?
Nowadays, I do. A lot of people actually call you and I as charmers.
I could see that.
We're very charming people when they speak to us, especially since I'm dark-skinned, I'm brown, and I'm quite the anomaly, and you are plus-size and gorgeous. Like, it throws people off.
Well, that was a nice compliment. Thank you.
Well, I love you being voluptuous. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness.
Cheers.
I promise you, ladies and gentlemen, there is no alcohol in this tea.
No. No, but I can't get, like, seriously drunk off of just, like, keep, you know, drinking this over and over. And I'm talking about just obsessing, not actual...
It does have a lot of layers.
Does
it? I will say.
Yes.
I was... Okay. I'm impressed at how many layers are in this tea.
All right. Well, I'm pretty sure the label on the tea tin will actually showcase that.
Yeah. Yeah, I could say I'm a persuasive person. I mean, I know what people want to hear.
Okay, you are being so humble. You speak in nothing but practical infomercial. You are like a walking commercial. Like, when you write things, when you say things, like, you actually make people try things that they usually don't want to, you know, do.
I convinced you
to
bodyboard with me.
Oh, yes! Oh my gosh, I didn't think I'd have so much fun, but I have.
Yeah, so Eugene didn't know that I used to surf when I was young.
No, you told me you surfed. It's just I didn't know how fast you were on the water.
But we just started small. We got some bodyboards this summer.
Yes.
Shout out to Bright and Diana for joining us this past weekend for Eugene's birthday. We're definitely going to be hitting the waves as much as we can.
Yeah. I have been converted to actually enjoy the beach as, I guess, bodyboarder. I can't say surfer. I've never...
We're moving up to it.
Right.
So the next board we're going to purchase is a Baylor board.
Exactly.
Which is a hybrid between a short board and a bodyboard. But anyways, do you find yourself more engaging in conversation, maybe?
Yes, but I think I started to actually engage in more conversations when I just became a reader. I didn't have to become a writer for it, but I am actually able to read people's attitudes, the people's perspectives, when I started writing.
So is, like, reading the gateway drug for conversation?
I really believe so. Like, if you don't read, I don't think you have much to say. You know, that's, I think, where people start becoming petty and start, you know, doing little, I guess, competitions with each other if they don't read. Because what else are you going to do to entertain your guests? So I think that as a reader, I actually got to talk more about other people rather than myself. You know that?
Actually, that's a good point. I feel like a very good writer skill that I've gotten is you become more in tune to the little things that make a person.
Yeah.
So, like, their gestures or the way they process information or the way they react to information. So, because you're more in tune to that, you're a little more likely to respond in a sensitive way.
Exactly. You become more of an empath.
Yeah.
So before I was reading, I would just talk about what I liked. I liked ice cream. I liked Dragon Ball Z. And then when I started reading, I start, you know, learning all these different things about, like, I don't know, dragons and, you know, like, how airplanes actually move and all that stuff. And then when you become a writer, I became a writer, I started noticing that people were reacting to some of these subjects differently. So I was able to actually cater to what they wanted to hear, and I was able to actually engage with them better.
Like prolong a conversation or make it more meaningful to that person?
Exactly. And the minute that people just run out of things to talk about, or rather they're just so caught up in talking about themselves rather than having a conversation with me, my sympathy to being, like, engaged is no longer, I guess, required. At least that's how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's not really insulting, it's just, I'm not part of this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So why should I stay And I think it should go vice versa, because I know people, when they're insecure, they will actually leave a conversation. And that's just how
people are. Even if that's just...
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, they don't really need to sometimes.
Like, just mentally tapping out.
Exactly. And that's normal, but you can't just blame it on yourself. And there's an interesting sense of responsibility towards each other when you actually have that kind of level of empath or empathy.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, great. Shall we move on to the next part of the article?
Yes, please.
So then it goes into what good writing does to your brain.
Ooh, good writing. Yes.
And it says the best writers know how to piece together certain concepts and information, and hack parts of the reader's brain.
That is amazing. Yes.
Yeah. And it goes into this 2006 study. Participants to read words with strong odor associations along with neutral words while their brains were being scanned by a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine. Anyway, so that's the study. They basically had them with neutral words and then odor associated words. And they were scanning their brain with this big machine. And it would actually trigger the smell parts of the brain, like sensory parts of the brain.
Okay.
Like you're getting stimulated as if you were smelling these things.
Okay, that makes sense.
So they also use touch words like velvet or smooth, and it would actually spark the sensors in it.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's intriguing.
So a good writer knows how to choose those words in order to put them together and stimulate.
I can definitely agree to that.
What are some of your favorite, like, stimulative pieces of writing?
Okay.
Let's go there.
I feel bad for mentioning this, but it is very true. Arturo Perez Reverte always writes about how a guy checks out a girl. Like, he will describe the bead coming down from her neck. He will describe the curve that actually embellishes when she's wearing silk. Like, it's really pervy, but it actually, like, it always wakes me up, I guess. It's a Spanish author, so the translation to the books aren't always are as articulate as it would be in the Spanish version. But for some reason, when it comes down to female worshipping, it's like something that he does a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, it kind of wakes me up to actually notice that maybe these things are a little important to people.
That's a very nice way of putting it.
Right, right. And then another one would be in The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit, how they talk about food.
Oh, God.
And, like, how it just makes you hungry.
Does anyone here listen to, my God, that YouTuber, he did Gale.
Ooh,
Chris Fleming, think?
Yeah.
He has a joke in one of his videos about, like, how you could, like, literally, like, everything sounds like a feast, and it, like, if anything's a feast, it sounds like a Redwall.
Yeah.
Like a Redwall book description, and I'm like, yes, I can, I'm there. In fact, guilty pleasure of mine, T-Spectral actually follows Redwall Games.
Oh, nice.
There's a company that's actually developing games based off of the Redwall books.
Right.
And they're trying to create a whole world where you can, like, build your own character and go in, which is amazing.
Yeah.
So one of the things they're doing for this season, I believe to raise funds or something, is they're actually building, like, cooking lessons.
Oh.
Inspired from the books, and I'm just like, bring it.
Yes.
Please. Yeah, absolutely. My goodness, what are some other really good food ones? You brought up Spanish authors again.
Yes.
I'm going to bring up my Spanish author, which is the Fon. Oh. And I just love the way he describes cafes. Am I allowed to talk about spoilers on this
podcast? Yeah, you can. I mean, like, if you guys haven't actually read the Fon yet, just go right ahead and pause. And probably, like, listen to this podcast again. When you've read it.
But the one I particularly remember, because it was written like a noir film, was Prisoner of Heaven.
Yes.
And if anyone's a huge fan, they know that the books are kind of the universe, but they're generational.
Yes.
So the main, one of the main characters in Shadow of the Wind, which is Daniel, I believe, he's like the son of the bookkeepers, like the bookstore owner.
Yeah.
You know that his mother's been dead and that his father was like madly in love with her, but you never know how she died or why. You just assume, oh, child labor, illness. But in Prisoner of Heaven, she's like a big deal. And she's actually trying to free this one author.
Mm.
And she gets poisoned at a cafe.
Oh.
And it just talks about just how the liquid slowly kills her. And I just, it's crazy. It's like all sensory overload.
And there, ladies and gentlemen, is the spoiler.
That's the spoiler. But she's incredible. And yeah, it's just quite the experience. I mean, for me, I think, what are words that I look for that I just...
Okay. I'm pretty sure this is a no-brainer for people that read John Keats.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy was accepting his death.
Yeah.
When he wrote Autumn. Mm-hmm. And whenever I read, like, any of those poems that talk about, you know, just relishing the day... And knowing that he was going to die, like, within, like, days, weeks, or months after that thing was published, it was just, it hits you hard. And I do gasp, I do cry, and I think Steph laughs at me for it sometimes. Just because, like, I'm trying to, like, woo her with John Keats, and I'm the one... That's actually having, like, my heart melt right in front of her.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, absolutely. Oh my god. No. Why? But that's just me being emotional.
So on the opposite end, there's this book I'm reading, and I just, you know, I listen to audiobooks while I'm, I guess, while I'm showering, while I'm cleaning.
Right.
I usually do it also as a downtime in between while I'm, like, before I teach my students, because I just need to get in, like, a literature mindset.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. I forgot the name of the author, but it's called 13 Ways of Looking at a Fat Girl.
Okay.
And it's actually the journey of someone who was obese as a child. And going over time, growing into a woman, but also losing the baby fat. And just the way her whole world is different.
Right.
But there's one thing, like, I just noticed while I was doing, while I was listening to it today. And it kind of gave me a good chuckle, because it sounds so sarcastic. It literally sounds like Daria, like Sick Sad World. But, like, in a ballad format for however long the book is.
Yeah.
And I realized that they are really good at pointing out the mediocre in that book.
Mm.
Like, there was even this description over how her salad was a salad.
Yeah.
And just how boring this salad was. Like, there's a whole episode about, or episode, sorry. There's, like, a whole chapter over how she had, like, an office mate, which was, like, this little quirky pinup girl, skinny girl.
Yeah.
And how she was, like, a foodie, and they would always have lunch together, and she would, like, pig out on all these desserts and fried foods. And then her being, like, trying to lose weight, she would just eat healthy or a salad.
Yeah.
And it was always, like, a routine that... the girl would be like, ew, are you really full? Are you lying? Don't you want a bite of this?
Yeah.
And it was just like this tango that they did. But she was just so good at describing how crappy it was to be in that situation, or like staying at her mom's place. Right. In her 30s, and how crappy her mom's taste was, and how, like, artificial
everything
is. Yeah, like, even down to, like, the magnets on the refrigerator passing as mediocre as best, and it's just, you know, back to that sensory thing, like, oh my goodness. And I just realized that's part of what makes the book so funny. Okay. It's just everything just sounds mediocre, even though she's having these life-changing situations. She's just like, eh. Eh. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, that's fantastic. So, is that all?
No, there's more.
Okay.
Here's how to read like a writer.
Oh. Okay.
So these are the tips.
Very good, then.
Okay. So, step one. Read the entire book at least once, even if you don't understand it.
I agree to that. How many people have actually read through the Iliad and not understand a word they were saying? We finished that stuff back in grade school.
No.
Yes, yes, even high school. And barely half of the class would understand what was going on.
Do you want to know how big of a nerd I was for that? I had a toga, and I would lounge around the house reading the Iliad in a toga.
See, you probably understood.
I am such a nerd.
You probably understood the art of oration, okay? That's like reading The Scarlet Letter and not preparing for a soap opera, okay? That is literally what The Scarlet Letter felt like when we first read as a class in my school. Like, we were all kind of looking at it like, are we seriously reading this again? Are we seriously just gonna, like, try to break our hearts again? Like, I am so bored of being so dramatic all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But you probably understood that that was what it was about, you know?
See, I picked it up knowing it was required reading, and I didn't even know what to think.
But you wore the toga?
Oh, no, oh, you were talking about Scarlet Letter.
Oh, yes, yes. No, no. Go ahead.
No, but like, when I read The Scarlet Letter, I don't know why we keep bringing it up today.
It's just a thing.
It's for a me. Thing, I guess. Yeah. I just kept thinking, when is this gonna end?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what we were thinking.
Like, I loved the characters. Like, till this day, like, I guess I, you know, in context of this, I didn't really understand what was going on until the end when, again, spoilers, I apologize.
Oh, please, everyone's read
Scarlet Letter. But, like, the guy comes out and he's like, okay, I did it.
And then hangs himself?
Yeah. No, but he didn't even, before he hung himself, he just, like, stood on the platform and there was, like, tons of ridicule. And I'm just like, why did it take so long?
To do it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
I feel it. I feel that.
Okay. Let's see. Most people have one goal in mind when reading, to download as much information. But there's the immersive experience is only partial when you first get into a book.
Right.
So what is one book you reread twice and you saw it, like, totally different?
Totally different?
Mm-hmm. Like, what was your first time realizing that was a thing?
American Gods.
Really?
Yeah. Like, the first time I read it, I hated that book. It was, like, too American for me. And it did not sound like the usual Neil Gaiman, you know, story. And I just wasn't feeling the whimsy. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm older and mm-hmm. I've reread it, it still is too American. It really sounds like Hemingway most mm-hmm. of the time. But I like it. You know? Like, for the sake of what it is. And suddenly, like, all these characters that pop in and out, all these little history lessons of actual American history, like, it was nice. It was refreshing. I hate to say it, but I feel like it is the anti-fairy tale.
I could see that.
You know?
Yeah.
So, when I actually went through it the second time around, I noticed all the little scenes that he actually made, all the little, I guess, like, items that the characters would pick up and put down, like, these wonderful montages that he paints for you.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen those paintings that portray, like, a theater play? And how one image in itself, like Othello holding his hands to his chest, would explain the whole scene to you. You know?
So, what is that, a streetcar named Desire?
Yeah, right? But that actually was just something I actually started to appreciate.
Okay. Reading. I would have to say Secret Garden. Reread.
I'm sorry. I can't take that book seriously.
No, but that's the thing. I think when you read it when you're young, you're forced to take it seriously.
Yeah, yeah. But when you're older, I just... Yeah. To me, it's like a really bad Victorian meme.
Loved it. I thought it was kind of cute. It was kind of like, hey, go outside, you know?
Yeah.
Make something of yourself and don't be lazy. And it was just, I mean, for those of you that don't know, my grandmother was Irish.
Right.
And I even have her Irish nose. It cracks me up. But yeah, she was like that all the time. And so, like, reading it, I'm just like, oh my God, it's grandma.
Oh. Well, okay, to me, The Secret Garden was the Asian pathway to becoming an Anglophile.
The Asian pathway.
Yeah, because every time I visited Asia, they were, like, obsessed with The Secret Garden.
I didn't know. Well, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. So, like, throughout my childhood, I'd hear it in different languages, and it would just literally be this ideology of what Western culture must be like.
It's kind of like Alice in Wonderland for Lolitas. And I'm just like, guys, there's like a whole genre of other books out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I get it. The tea, the silliness, and the little girl thing, that's awesome. But, like, man, there is so much more out there.
There is.
Yeah.
But I can still respect it. The book is actually really well written.
Which one?
The Secret Garden.
Oh, The Secret Garden. Okay. Yeah.
And I do actually understand the whole point of the story, and it's just, I just can't look at it the same way, though. You know,
yeah.
Every time I reread that scene, like, boy, why are you crying? And, you know, the little boy's like, because I can't walk. And the girl's like, have you tried? And he's like, no.
See, I remember, like, I distinctly remember that scene, like, especially since I read it in school. What was it, like, fourth grade? Like, it was very distinctly like, and this guy, he's in bad, bad shape, you know? He's just, you know, like, everything's wrong. But, like, after reading it the second time, I'm just like, no, I mean, truth be told, like, you know, he just needs to get out there. And, like, everyone kind of just understood that.
Yeah.
It wasn't as blown out as, I guess, even the movie puts it.
Okay, I think that's why I actually laugh at it now.
Yeah.
It's because of the movies.
Yeah.
Because when you read it, it's very heartwarming.
I guess on a 30-year-old perspective or a 30-something perspective, it's just like, boy, you need to work your core muscles.
Yeah.
And just get out there just and get some fresh air. You know?
I mean, like, you got so much land.
Like, if you have FOMO, just go deal with it, boy.
It's like, you're not even paying rent. Come on,
yeah,
man.
Just do it. Yeah. Anyways. Yeah. So, I agree with this. What's the second one? Look for author's persuasion tactics. Okay, now this is something I am such a stickler about. This is like the first thing I notice in a book.
Okay.
anyone else struggle with your first chapter? Or maybe you're like me where you love starting a chapter, but then you never... Like, you're very good at starting every chapter, but you're very bad at finishing chapters.
That makes a lot of sense.
Like, wrapping up chapters.
Yeah. I remember actually going through my first try at being a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Could not get past page 18.
Yeah.
I could, like, every single time I retried.
Do you remember those days when you're like, I wrote 4 pages. I'm awesome.
Yeah, and I didn't even do double indentations.
Yeah.
Just, and my God.
You know. But it's definitely a skill you work towards.
Yes.
But, yeah, I notice that all the time. I'm noticing, let's see. His goal is to believe... No.
What? Was it? What is it?
It's talking about persuading, like, there's a journalist that talks about persuading readers, and his 3 points is that his idea is valid, that he has the authority to write about the idea, and that the idea is worth caring about. And that's what you should be looking for. I don't know. I mean, it's a good point.
As a journalist... I will agree that that is exactly what you're supposed to do.
But I think that's a terrible point in this article.
It is. It is. But I'm saying that journalists, when they actually look for stories, they should already make their conclusions so they can actually piece it together, which is what makes good journalism good. But as a novelist, you are trying to actually make the scene empathetic and engaging and... You can't just be there to say, I am right.
Oh, I see. So they're suggesting that the next time you read a book, look closely for the parts that trigger your those three persuasion points.
Okay.
And how to apply them. I look at details. I want to know, like we brought up earlier, like how do they finish dialogue? When is too much dialogue, too much dialogue? When do you add descriptions? How do the descriptions tie in? There's like a running stereotype that every author starts by talking about the weather.
Yes.
Oh my God. Chapter one. And I'm guilty of that. And I don't know anyone that isn't guilty of that. But I'm very conscious about that now. So I always... When I open up a book, I'm always curious. And yeah, I'm one of those readers that will now judge a book based on the first chapter. And okay. I'm really sad to say, but a lot of books are just horrible first chapters.
Yeah, well, that's why I usually think that you're not really reading the book until you make it to chapter 3.
See, I have a policy on my reading techniques that, like, even audiobooks, I'll try to get to 25% at least before I announce that I'm reading a book. Because if you haven't gotten me like a fourth through, then you're not going to get me through the rest. I'm right. just going to begrudgingly finish your book. And nobody wants that.
No. I know like a quick way to engage yourself into a book is literally just opening up like somewhere in the middle of the book. And finishing the book. Because if you're not engaged by, like, the midway progression of the story to the ending, then obviously the beginning's not even going to be relevant to you.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the juicy stuff is always in the middle. Always.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyways.
Let's see. Next part is take notes of the metaphors.
Maybe. I mean, I like when you annotate over certain ways that authors have actually expressed scenes, people, feelings. But that's nice to steal as a writer. But as for a reader, I feel like maybe, perhaps, you know, that's a good thing. It is a good thing.
Well, they're talking about how, depending on how well you use your metaphors, you can unlock, like, sensory cortexes in the brain.
Yeah.
Which allows your audience to be stimulated.
Okay, I've actually had a conversation about this, And I always lean more towards the syntax of a paragraph than how you describe a certain scene. I mean, mind you, I will admit, I will always fall for Zelda Fitzgerald's descriptions and metaphors. Always. Because they're just amazing. I don't know what... Like, where she actually picked that up, you know, in the South. But...
I can see it from the South.
Yeah.
Because everything's kind of a saying and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, just that kind of stuff is actually nice to have. But if it doesn't sound right in your ear, of course you're not going to actually, you know, listen to it. You know, consonants are important to actually let the vowels, like, sing when you are reading a certain page. And sometimes when you actually read it in silence, it describes differently in your brain than when you actually say it out loud.
So, since you brought up Snicket before...
Yes.
A lot of people don't realize this, but as a reader, you realize that there is so much reference to other writers in his books.
Yes.
And he writes homages through... A lot of people don't know this, but he's, like, an excellent poet. And just, like you were talking about, the syntaxes or... Yes. Just the way he writes a certain thing. Like, most kids think it's silly when you read it. Like, oh, he's just being weird again. But a lot of the different techniques that he throws at you in your writing are, like, total homages.
Yeah.
One of my favorite ones is it's the one about the elevator.
Okay.
And it's actually a play, I believe, on a Vivaldi play.
Ah, yes.
Or an opera. Right. And, like, just the way it's written is the different tragedy tropes of an anti-hero in opera.
Right.
And it's so beautifully written. but I perk up when I hear those things. In fact, there's some books I won't even read yet by Christopher Moore.
Yeah.
Because they're homages to classic writing.
Yeah.
And I won't be able to appreciate it as much. So
I was actually pretty excited when I read the last book in the series of unfortunate events, and it ended with a Patriarchan sonnet.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you actually read it properly, each line represented the book, like each book, and you realize he practically wrote his own version of Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, we were talking about that. I mean, if you don't, how many circles in hell were there?
Nine.
So,
but in a Patriarchan sonnet, it pivots. I think after the sixth line. Mm-hmm. Six or eight, I forgot. But it actually divulges into basically the Italian classic style of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And countless times, whenever you read somebody's writing and you think it's amazing, ask yourself, did they rewrite Dante's Inferno? That's, like, a very common thing in the publishing industry. Very common. And I felt like he did it on purpose rather than by accident, like most writers.
Mm-hmm.
And he took advantage of it.
Daniel Handler, the actual guy behind Lemony Snicket, the pen name, he did not want to write this series.
Yes.
This was him down on his luck. I mean... I think we talked about this in previous episodes, but he's all about, again, opera. And, yeah. Like, he had a novel he was pitching for years, which was about incest and love in the opera.
Yeah.
And murder. So, I mean, just really dark undertone themes. And he just couldn't get a cut. And finally, people are like, we want you to write children's books. We want you to teach kids how to read. And he was just like, no, no, no. So he did this almost like the Sistine Chapel. It was Michelangelo. Yeah. Like, he just had such a disdain for it. And that's why he came up with the pen name Lemony Snicket. Because he was, like, thinking of all the horrible things he could put in it, and one of them was, like, occults. So he did research by asking for pamphlets from different occults, and he used a fake alias, which was Lemony Snicket.
Which rhymed with...
with Jiminy Cricket, which is supposed to be this, like, little conscience on the side of you, and... yeah, it's always fun to hear that.
Yeah.
But...
he's a brilliant man, I think.
He is phenomenal. Actually, if anyone has a chance on YouTube, he was his valedictorian. And they actually have his speech on there.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think of that. I think of that kind of stimulation.
Okay.
What else? I think that's it, really.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I think I'm fine with that. I can live with it.
Yeah. So, I guess, what can we take away from this? Like, how do you feel that...
how did we score becoming writers to this article? How well do you think you scored? Like, 1 out of 10. Like, 10 being the best. Like...
I think I was probably a 5 or 6 at the best.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm like a 4.
Yeah?
Yeah. Like, I get it, you know, all these points are amazing. They actually hit you with the psyche that you actually get being a writer.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like in my experience, because I went towards the direction of pleasing my clients or pleasing my audience.
Well, we should bring that up, actually. Eugene is now officially a ghostwriter.
Yes, thank you.
So, in context of what we're saying.
Yeah.
So,
I have done nothing but do what was expected of me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's amazing if you're looking for just making a buck. But as a writer, I really do not think it is the path to grow as a writer.
Well, I can agree with that. I mean, on that note, like, right when I got out of college, I was a articleist for a while.
Yeah.
And that's what I did for a living for a short period of time. I think it was like one summer, but yeah, I never, like, there's this fine line of trying to please your audience and, like, at the same time giving your way to stand out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's a very hard balancing act to, you know, perform. I mean, I think the easiest time you've probably had in finishing a book was when I finally told you, if you feel like you're writing crap, then just write crap. Because you're so enamored by your favorite authors. You can't help but, you know, constantly compare yourself to the greats.
Yeah.
And it belittles you so often that you become such a perfectionist. And perfection is not what we need when you know, when it comes down to a book project. We need a finished product. And you actually got to do that once.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And yeah. Now all we have to do is just edit.
Yeah.
And I feel like you got to actually grow as a writer, you know? Like, every time I read your stories, it feels like I could actually taste the air that they're breathing. You know, I can hear and understand the disdain that people might have for each other, or that the love that they actually feel, that kind of warmth. And it makes me want that when mm-hmm. I read it.
Well, that's good.
So, it's wonderful, you know? I think the way you actually progressed as a writer is brilliant.
I feel like reading was also my textbook. And I was just really fortunate that I was, I guess I would call it a renaissance. But I don't know if anyone noticed this. Shout out, like, please DM me or contact me. But, like, somewhere around 2006 through 2014, there was almost like a renaissance during the recession.
Of, like, children's books.
For children's books.
Yeah.
And I feel like I learned a lot from them, and they were like my textbooks. It's just, it was a coincidence that I fell into it because I was an art major at the time. You know, I was doing my graphics, but also one of my teachers is actually on the Children's Illustration Society Guild, and she was going to sponsor me. And so, like, I was just obsessed with, like, ingesting as much children's books as possible. And at that time, like, I got to see things in a different light. And that's kind of what segued me back into reading. Because, yeah, I mean, let's be real. When you read novels sometimes, like, it just gets dry.
Yeah, like,
like, you feel like you just can never touch it or attain it. And I was getting that feeling. But when I saw it through the eyes of a child on these children's books, I mean, there's a lot of substance there, you know? I'm sorry if you guys notice this, but I always bring up children's books or, like, young adult in our story, you know, in our book recommendations. But please do yourselves a favor and read these authors. I mean, I just think, you know, they're such phenomenal storytellers. And I think what makes them so amazing as opposed to, like, adult writers also is just they have to be very sensitive to their audience.
Yeah.
But there's a certain talent to be said about portraying feelings, especially growing pains or reactions to, like, giant life tragedies.
Yeah.
And doing it in a way where a child can grasp it and associate with it. Okay. And I think that's a real skill. And that taught me how to write a lot.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, like, the hardest part in being a writer is actually finding your voice.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the things I've done is literally just copy other people's voices.
Really?
Well, that's what you literally do most of the time as a ghostwriter. You
have to. Oh, that's true.
You know, I can't just go right ahead and actually articulate them into, like, a British grammar when they're trying to write a fairy tale, when obviously the author himself doesn't actually do that most of the time in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fantastic thing to have a voice as a writer. You know, it's something that you aim for. When you're an artist, mm-hmm. since you do designs and graphic designs, people notice your style.
Yeah.
Between the lines. Other people can try to do the same exact thing, but they can't follow your exact style. I've tried.
Yeah. You
know, back when I used to actually sketch.
Oh, maybe we should show them that. So one of the ways Eugene and I fell in love is we tried to do
a manga
together for the Rising Stars contest with Tokyo Pop.
Ah, I miss them.
Yeah, and I know Luke's listening. Luke, yes, we were babysitting you that day too.
Oh my god, yes. So. Yeah, just to let you guys know, I'm actually publishing a writer through Azure Lorica.
The nonprofit that Eugene and I co-founded.
Yes, so shout out to him. His book's going to be releasing this year.
I vote cheers.
Cheers. To the writers.
To the writers. I guess this is going to be a really interesting season.
Yeah. I mean, I am looking forward to bringing up writing complexes, like the dreaded deadline and the
writer's block.
The mythical writer's block.
Interesting to talk about, but we're looking forward to it.
Yes, definitely.
And anything we've learned in our short time of being writers.
Ooh, let's dig into this. Yeah. Oh my goodness. I am ready for this season. So
on that note, we'll leave you to your books and or your writing.
And please enjoy the teas when they release.
Yes. So again, if any of you have the time this coming Sunday, it'll be noon my time in LA, and in New York it's around 3. So I guess adjust accordingly. But on the T-Spectral Instagram, we are going to be going live with It's a Charming Life, and we're going to talk about their lifestyle, how the tea was made. I'm actually a little nudge, nudge, I guess, in the context of a giveaway.
Oh, okay.
But, you know.
Right.
It's book-related. I'm actually going to be sharing a little bit of literary inspiration.
Nice.
With the teas.
Okay.
So I hope to see some of you there. And yeah, I'd love you guys to ask questions. Most of you are really on point with your questions and your commenting. So again, thank you so much for, you know, just being good sports and interacting and sharing your reading lists with us.
That's a very humble way of saying being such an awesome audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, oh my God.
And then some of you that have crossed over from T-Spectral to Bibliosinensis, thank you, and vice versa.
Yes.
Thank you guys so much. I guess we will hear from you soon, and if anything, I'll see some of you writing comments in the live stream this coming Sunday.
All right.
So cheers, everyone.
Cheers.